Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello, everybody. This is Fran Lewis, and guess what? It's freezing outside, but it's not snowing, and the sun is shining in upstate New York. So it's beautiful, and I'm going to introduce my guest in just a moment, and boy, are you going to be surprised. We're going to have a great show and an amazing author. But first, I am totally pumped and excited that the third edition of MJ Magazine is out. And for those of you that would like to submit articles for MJ4, just email me at riffy1@optonline.net and tell me what you have in mind. For those authors that would like me to promote their title, their book, or business, and would like to take out an ad in the magazine for a small fee, not a big one, just a little one, because all the money and proceeds for the magazine goes to the Ruth Swerdloff Memorial Fund at Montefiore Hospital in memory of my mom, who died of Alzheimer's 3 years ago last Friday. So for those of you that would like to take on an ad, please email me and let me know. And this magazine features articles on hatocracy, which is illegal immigration, Fran's picks, writing tips, book reviews, Laurie Forster and her three new novels, David Baldacci, and a whole bunch more. But right now, I would like to introduce author of more than 60 novels, oh my goodness, and translated into 24 languages, oh wow, born and raised on the western edge in rural Massachusetts, I would like to introduce Carla Negers, the author of Declan's Cross, and then my new favorite novel, Cyderbrook. Hi, Carla.
Hi, how are you, Fran?
Oh, okay.
Ready for spring? I think we're all ready for March to turn into a lamb any moment.
Oh, yeah, I am ready for, you know, yesterday, and I was walking outside, I'm terrible, my mother used to say to me, put on a jacket, and yeah, right, my father never wore one either, neither does my nephew, and it was like 48 or 50 degrees, and I'm walking around with no jacket on. I was happy. This morning, it's 35 mile an hour winds, and I said, I think I'll skip walking today.
It got so cold. I'm in Vermont on my hilltop, and
oh, nice.
We got almost two feet of snow. So I said, "Oh, don't let the power go out. I need to talk to you today." So, but it's inspiring to have the snow. I'm telling myself because I'm actually writing a Christmas novella that follows up on Cyderbrook in the Swift River Valley series.
I was hoping you would say that. Because Samantha, well, let's talk about the book for a few minutes, because this is Women's History, people, and I picked Carla Negers as the first fantastic woman author to celebrate women's writers. Ha-ha, how about that? So, Samantha Bennett, how did you create her? She really is tough.
She's a fun character for I mean, she's one of those ones who just kind of jumps off the page. I could see her. She's an adventurer and a treasure hunter who comes from a family of adventurers. So her grandfather actually was an explorer who went to the Antarctic. So how do you stand out in a family like that, right? I mean, you can't top that. So, so Samantha comes to this little town I created out in West Central Massachusetts on the edge of the Quabbin Reservoir. And the reservoir was created about 75 years ago when four little towns were wiped off the map and the river in the valley allowed to flood that whole valley and create the reservoir. And there's these little towns on the edge. And so I actually grew up in one of them, and my family homestead is still there, my mom and my brother and stuff. So I created Knightsbridge and populated it with kind of interesting characters. Samantha's not from Knightsbridge. The one time she's in Knightsbridge, she got herself into trouble with her treasure hunter mentor, who is now, it's 2 years ago, and he's died, but she wants to make amends. She wants to kind of redeem herself because she felt like she has this pirate mystery and this whole adventure that she's been wrapped up in. So she goes to Knightsbridge where she thinks a pirate kind of was there 300 years ago in the area and buried treasure. So she's got a bit of a mission, and she arrives. She thinks she's going to sneak into town and sneak right out again and prove herself, and it doesn't quite work out that way. I mean, just starts out with just one of those days. It's a, you know, those kind of we get them in the Northeast, the late when fall, we think fall has started and everything is crisp and beautiful, but we get one of those humid days and you get the thunderstorm out of the blue. Well, that's what happens with Samantha, as she is. Now, she wants a strong woman. She's taken it upon herself to follow this brook, Cider Brook, through the woods and down into where it empties into the reservoir, because she believes, and there's a lot of background to all of this, but she believes that there are answers to this pirate treasure and his history are somewhere on this brook, and that there she might run into this old cider mill that she believes is a clue in the mystery. So she finds this abandoned cider mill. It's a wreck. Just as, you know, the skies open up, and of course, this is the kind of day she's been having, where she dives into the cider mill and it catches fire with lightning. And who should own the cider mill but our guy Justin Sloan? And believe me, it takes a strong woman to deal with Mr. Sloan. He's a lot of fun.
Takes an even stronger one, not to just say, "Oh, what the heck? He's gorgeous."
Yeah. So Justin owns the cider mill, and he may or may not know something about our pirate mystery, our 300-year-old pirate mystery. When you think about an area, like if you go, and especially one along in this area where towns had just been wiped off the map, and you create a protected wilderness to for the reservoir so that Boston can have pure drinking water, and see if this area was populated, and then it wasn't populated, and then now you have these little towns that are still there and very contemporary in their own way, and yet you go into them and they're pretty towns, and you just think, oh, time stopped there, but it really hasn't. So you can imagine in 300 years the different things that have happened in this one little area of the cider mill. And I mean, I even know in the place where I grew up on the western edge of the reservoir, and in a 18th century carriage house that we moved to, and we were not old time New Englanders. My father was a Dutch sailor, and my mother, speaking of strong women, she's still with us. She's from the Florida Panhandle, so she moved up. They moved up to New England right before I was born, and to help a family. That is a long story, but anyway, we ended up in this 18th century carriage house in these woods, and in the woods. You know, there's all the old stone walls that go through the woods. Well, they used to be fields. The land used to be cleared. So you think about that, and then we find these old cellar holes out in the woods. So the history, to me, is just present. And so, of course, we're going to have, like, inside a brook, we have Samantha looking for pirate treasure. But, you know, just being out, so she's following this brook, and she comes to the old cider mill, and you wonder, well, okay, when was that built? And as a writer, I'm asking myself, okay, so when was it? And it was 19th century. Well, that is 200 years after her pirate was in the area. So if the cider mill was built then, and what's it going to be now with this guy coming in? You know, what's he going to do with it, and who is he, and what does he know about her and her past in Knightsbridge, her one day? So we get, you know, this is all just as the story starts. It's this whole piece where she just thinks she's just going to sneak in, sneak out, and boom. So we have a quite a beginning, and she is Samantha is definitely a strong woman. She has to be with her family. Her father is this treasure hunter who's actually, he's an underwater explorer is the way I would think of it, where he's going after old World War II submarines and diving down to see that history of World War II. And now we have a lot of treasure hunters or underwater explorers who are going after the old pirate ships. So that's out in the ocean. And you think, okay, pirates, they were on ships, right? Why would they be inland? Why would a pirate have come inland? And that's what Samantha's trying to prove and trying to figure out in Ciderbrook.
Well, she's probably very, very independent. She sounds independent. And every time he tries to help her, she sort of like says, I could do it myself. Even as far as he invites her to stay at the Carriage Hill, and she gives him a hard time about that, and she even wants to sleep in her tent. She's got stubborn all the way.
That's right. She's independent, and she really just determined to prove herself. And sometimes you, when you have a mission, you can get a little bit of tunnel vision. And here it is. So it's a beautiful, beautiful autumn, New England autumn, and we have the thunderstorm that comes in, and then it clears out. But it's a little cold, and you can get the. And she said, "Well, you're going to sleep out by yourself in a brook in the woods?" And she's like, "Yes. I will do that. I want to do that." And in a way, that's part of her proving to herself about her own independence, her own sense of adventure. Again, she has the father who's the underwater explorer. She has an uncle who's this maritime historian, and we have, and then her grandfather who she has been going through all of his archives, basically his house, his closets, his desk, and everything after he died in the last 2 years. So she's steeped in all this sense of adventure. And it is a fun thing when we think about ourselves. You know, you look at a character like Samantha Bennett, and you think, would I do something like that? You know, have I done something like that? I think we would, yeah.
Maybe not I don't know if I'd sleep outside, but I definitely am stubborn. And I definitely, I think just like her, have my own identity. I said, because growing up, I was always Marcia's sister, my sister MJ, Ruth's daughter, Tova's niece, my aunt, who told me I was going to be an educator at the age of 3. And luckily for me, I listened since. And Susan's cousin. I mean, that's how I was. Noted. That's Ruth's daughter, Tova's niece, Marcia's sister, Susan's cousin. I didn't have a name. So you sort of want to build your own identity. And I think Samantha just wants to prove, apart from her father and apart from her mother and everybody and her grandfather, who plays a big part in this, even though he's not there anymore, that she's who she is. Because what happens when they find out that she's Harry Bennett's granddaughter, things sort of change. And then, of course, he doesn't trust her.
And, yes, Justin Sloan doesn't trust her, and for good reason, because she didn't tell the whole truth, but she had her reasons, and she believes they were honorable reasons for not telling the whole truth about herself. But it does, how do you rebuild that trust? And she she's from a strong, definitely strong men in her family, and so when she meets Justin, she's not at all intimidated, and he knows that, and he kind of plays to it, too, but he's like, he knows that she broke into the cider mill. Now, she thinks she's doing just a perfectly sensible thing because she's getting out of this fierce thunderstorm. And she has no idea that at that point that he knows who she is. And so he takes exception to it. And he's kind of like, I know you broke in. Give me my lock. I want my lock back. So it's fun.
He took something of hers, and she knew that too. That was so clever.
Samantha is very. She's an expert on pirates. She is. She's done her research. She's got her materials, and she's an expert on this particular pirate, Captain Faraday, and she's discovered a story written about him by someone she thinks may be from Knight's Bridge in the past, and she's trying to put all these pieces together. So we have a puzzle to solve in Knight's Bridge. It's not suspense in the sense that there's a dead body or people are in serious danger, but there's definitely questions and things to solve, a bit of a lot of stuff going on in the story. And so Samantha has written it down, and I mean, when this place catches fire, the thing is you just got to get out. And she smells the smoke, and she's just got to get out. And she does try to take She's got one of the, you know those vests they have now when you hike, and you get in those jackets. They got like 8 million pockets in them. Yeah, those are great. But hers is loaded down. She's got her whiskey flask, you know, from her grandfather. That's as much a source of, you know, like, it's almost like her rabbit's foot, or to remind her of her grandfather. But she's got that in there. She's got all kinds of stuff. But, you know, what happens to the little notebook? You know, and Justin finds it. So there's a lot of games that they play with each other as they try to figure out what each one is up to, what they know about the pirate treasure. You know, what would you do if you found pirate treasure out in the woods, you know?
Yeah, wouldn't you not give it back, maybe? But you know what? When I read what you wrote, you know, she wrote about Benjamin Faraday and Lady Elizabeth, and then you get to know her and Justin, it's interesting. The story sort of blend together.
Isn't it fun? And
So
we have Samantha has discovered in her grandfather's things. Remember, she's going through. He's died 2 years ago, and she's been going through his desk, his office, his closet, and she finds these manuscript pages written by a woman. She can kind of tell us and she's trying to figure out what it, and it's about this Lady Elizabeth and Captain Faraday, and it's sort of a romantic pirate story, and that's, we see little bits and pieces of that throughout Cider Brook, because Samantha is taken with this story and how Captain Faraday, you know, and Lady Elizabeth do parallel a little bit of our modern day Samantha and Justin.
Well, tell our listeners, why did you decide to become an author? What made you decide that you wanted to write novels?
You know, I started writing stories as a kid. I would climb a tree and sit up on my favorite branch with a pad and pen or loose paper, whatever I could find, and I would spin stories. I could lean back on a certain branch. So I had my butt on one branch, lean back on another branch, and I could put my feet up,
nice.
And I'd sit up there. And so I could do no hands. I couldn't do it now. It was, you know, that's a little bit much, but it didn't faze me at that age. And I just loved to spin stories. I loved to read, so I would sit up in that tree and read a lot too. But I was always driven to write stories, and wherever that came from, it grabbed me early, and it's held on ever since. And I love to write as much now as I did as a kid. I just love to tell stories. I think to a degree, some of it comes from my own upbringing. I mentioned that my father was a Dutch sailor, and my mother was from the Florida Panhandle, and I was born in New England. Well, we didn't go to Holland. There was no money to go to Holland and visit relatives, or for them to come to my little town and visit us. And there was, you know, that Florida might as well have been Holland. I mean, we just didn't do that. And so I would be able to visualize my parents' lives before New England through their stories. And my father had been a merchant marine at. His family was trapped during World War II in Holland, and he was at sea with his brother, and all their adventures. So we got those stories of, you know, it was quite dangerous world there, and then he went to, all over the world as a sailor. So it was hearing his stories and my mother's stories about growing up, I think, helped me to learn to. The detail, like visualizing things through story, visualizing people through story, and then what made up the elements of a good story. So I think, and also just having six brothers and sisters. I'm third of seven, and there's seven of us within 9 years. And so writing and storytelling, it was a great, you know, great way to just climb up my tree and be in my own world and not have to, I mean, I adore my family. We had a great time, but sometimes, you know, you just got to go off by yourself, right?
You got it. What was the very first story you ever wrote? Do you remember?
The very first story I wrote. Well, I was always writing bits and pieces, but the first one the first novel I finished, let's put it that way, I called it The Bronze Buddha. And it was about a woman. And I was a student. And see, think about the stuff I've been writing since then. And she was this archaeology student. And she worked at a motel cleaning rooms, and she came, okay. And that was one of my first jobs as a kid, was cleaning motel rooms with my friend Cindy. And it just had to have something to think about, right? So you go in, and you never know what you're going to find when you're cleaning a motel room, let me tell you. So you go in, and here's the bed. And I thought, well, what would happen if I found this, you know, throw back the shower curtain and find some guy wounded. Okay, what would I do then? What would happen? And then off I went and I wrote the Bronze Buddha. I wonder where it is. I think I've got it in the house somewhere.
That sounds like a book I would love to read. Definitely. Definitely. It's my kind of strange book. I mean, I was waiting in the middle of Cedarbrook for a body to fall in one of the brooks or one of the holes or one of the in the grandfather's house as she was digging out. I said, wait a minute. This is a good place for a dead body, and I was glad there wasn't one. So what do you feel are your strengths as a best-selling New York Times best-selling author?
Oh, isn't that a wonderful question?
I try.
Well, you know, I love a good story, and I think that my strength is just creating the good story and doing the very best I can to get it onto the page. And you have the Swift River Valley series, which you mentioned doesn't have the dead body and the suspense. And then I also have a lot of suspense novels, and the Sharp and Dunavant series have the suspense.
Yep.
But what I try to do are create characters, whatever their situation is. They're character-driven stories. And for me, it's having those characters, someone like Samantha Bennett and Justin Sloan, jump off the page. And even we get to know the Samantha's grandfather, even though he's dead by the time the story starts. He's just a character. And for me, as a writer, a storyteller, that's what I love it when that happens, when a character feels real to me. And they kind of, like if they walked into my office, I would know them. So it's not about, it's really not about hair color or, you know, what size shoe they wear or anything like that. It's about who they are and what drives them. And you can see that with a character like Samantha Bennett, that she has a mission. She has there's something that's going to drive her into and through this story.
Yeah, your characters are true to life. They're not like, you know, plastic. They're not contrived. You could tell that these people could actually live in a small town, and you could actually meet these people in a town. That's what makes the story so good, because it's so realistic. And the setting, I mean, there are places like that. And I'm saying like the setting. How do you determine where to make the story, and how do you visualize the setting? Because when I see it, and I don't even need the cover of the book to know where it was or what the setting was or how it looked.
Yeah, the sense of place is something that I love to create in a book, and I think that's one of my strengths. The readers tell me that they can feel the place, they can visualize it there, they feel like they're there, whether it's Ireland or Boston or Maine, coastal Maine, or the Swift River Valley series in this fictional town of Knightsbridge. But the area itself is real. Quabbin Reservoir is real. As I mentioned, I grew up there, and I had not set a book right in this area ever of all the books that I've written. And when I came up with the Swift River Valley series, it was just this character of Grace Webster, who is in her 90s now in the series, and she grew up in one of these lost towns, and I create a story, and it involves a jewel thief, about her last days in the town before it was flooded. So her home was taken, all the businesses, everything went out of these valleys. They scraped, I mean, they were creating a reservoir. They're creating drinking water for people. So they created a pristine bottom for in the valley where these towns were. It had they scraped it all out: trees, houses, businesses, foundations. Everything went. The graves went. They moved the cemetery. You can go visit Quabbin now, and you can go and visit where they moved the Civil War monuments, the World War I monuments, and they put them into this. They created it's a park-like cemetery. So everything had to go. And I imagine, you know, and I had grown up with people who had been, you know, they were obviously older than I am. They were my parents' age and older, who had been in this, in these towns. And so I just created my own character of Grace, and I her last days in this area, and then how that impacts today, and what's going on today in this little town and in her life, because she's still alive. And so that's how I came up. It was really from the character, the setting, the history, all of that coalescing, and I just knew I had to write this book. And that's the first one in the Swift River series, Secrets of the Lost Summer. And then we have That Night on Thistle Lane, and now Ciderbrook. You can read them individually, or you can read them. A lot of people, I don't know how you are, but a lot of people like to read, you know, 1, 2, 3. They like to start. I'll dive in into the middle of a series. I don't have any problem with that. But when I really get into it, then I kind of like to go back and read them in order.
Well, I received this a couple of weeks ago from Veronica Grossman as a present. And I said, oh, my goodness, this is a nice present. And, you know, there are days, like I said, I have like over 40-some-odd books to review. I go, oh, finally something that I want to read. You know, you get so many, and then you get something that just stands out like this one did. But let's not forget Emma and Clarence Cross and all the strong characters in that. She's a little different, but not really. So how did you create her, and how does she differ from Samantha Bennett? Because the Clarence Cross was, that also, by the way, came in the mail as a surprise. And I said, oh, okay, who sent me this? And I was, like, so excited. I couldn't put it down. And when I was finished with it, my brother-in-law has it, and he won't give it back. I just want you to know. and he's waiting for this one, too. He emailed me
before.
Awesome. He says, when you're done with the interview, just make sure it goes in my pile of books. I go, yeah, okay. And yeah,
it's
I know he's, you know, a lot of people, my family, some read, some don't, but my brother-in-law, my husband's brother, Larry, does. And when he heard that I was doing the interview with you, he says, okay, what book didn't I get? So he takes all of yours. He takes Steve Berry's.
Oh, he's great. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he is great. And I have to hide the rest of them, because otherwise I'll lose more. But so how did you create Emma?
Well, Emma Sharp she is an interesting character. She's an FBI agent. She's part of my Sharp and Donovan series. And the other FBI agent is Colin Donovan. And Emma, she has a strong relationship with her grandfather, Wendell Sharp, but he's still alive. And he's a world-renowned private art detective, Sharp Fine Art Recovery. And Emma became an FBI agent specializing in art crimes. But she's had kind of an interesting path to being an FBI agent, which we explore in the series. And so she started out, actually, she thought she was going to be a nun. There was a beautiful convent near where she grew up in southern Maine. And, you know, and that was just a something she went and did while she was a student, art history student, and she learned the convent specializes in art preservation and conservation and education, art education. So that was right up her alley, and so but she didn't stay. She didn't take make her final vows, and she then instead became an FBI agent. And along comes Colin Donovan, who grew up in a little fishing village not far from where she grew up in southern Maine. So they have that in common, but they have a lot that's not in common at all. So they're quite a pair. They meet in Saints Gate, which is the first book in the series. And Colin is an undercover agent, and he's just coming off of a very difficult mission with illegal arms traffickers. and there's a murder of a nun. And Emma's a very independent character, very self-contained. Some of it's just her nature and who she is, and some of it is her training as an art historian, and some of it is her experience in the convent with meditation and everything. So she's just kind of self-contained, and Colin is not. So Colin is he relies. I mean, he's a lot of training and experience, but he's learned to make very quick decisions and rely on his gut. And Emma is, she thinks and she's analytical. And so they're an interesting pair, but she's a very, very strong person. She has a lot of internal strength. She, you know, and she will do what she has to do to get the job done.
Yeah, she's a very interesting character. Like I said, I got that one and Cyderbrook. They sort of gave it to me in the middle of the series, but that's okay because I catch on fast. That was not a problem.
Yeah, and I try to write the story so that you don't need a scorecard to figure out, well, okay, what's going on here with the previous book. So they're not, I think, like if you're writing an actual trilogy where it's one, two, three, beginning, middle, and end, it's a little bit different than when you're writing books that, if they do refer, and they often do, to previous books and the stories that happen in them or characters reappear, that you can follow it. You're not lost as a reader. You might have to pay a little attention there to figure some things out. But I think in Cyderbrook, you mentioned Carriage Hill, and this is the inn that Olivia Frost owns. And Olivia is the character, the heroine in Secrets of the Lost Summer, who helps, serves kind of as a catalyst for Grace Webster, the woman in her 90s, for her secrets to come out. And so you think about a little town like Knightsbridge and it, and the many, many secrets it could have. And so Olivia, a smaller role, but she does appear in Cyderbrook. But it's logical to the story because Justin, who's a volunteer firefighter, is also a carpenter and part of the Sloan family, and there's six of them, five brothers and one sister. And they're helping to build a new house and a barn in where Grace's old house used to be, right up the road from Olivia's inn. And so it's natural for Justin. Olivia grew up, she's from the town. Justin's from the town. They're friends. They know each other. And so when you know, it's just like Samantha, it's just like you just survived a fire. It's thunderstorms. It's raining. Okay, you can stay in. You could stay in a nice house, you know, a nice inn here, and have you know, apple cake and a decent meal. So she stays in Carriage Hill, and so the readers who've already met Olivia and know her story get to see her again, but it's very organic and natural to Cyderbrook and what's going on in that story.
The food alone, and I'm on a special diet, and I'm thin, and I'm not allowed to eat any of that stuff, and I was like, apple cake and all the chicken and all the stuff. I was getting hungry just reading it. and the breakfast that I'm only allowed to eat oatmeal and I can't have pancakes or any of that. And I'm saying, like, I just want to go there just so I could eat people food. It sounds, oh, my God. They don't make places like that anymore. Well, not up here anyway. Maybe in Vermont, but not here. So if you were a character in one of your novels, would you be the good person, the protagonist, or the antagonist? And what kind of occupation do you think you would have if you were the character in your novel?
Oh, how fun. Well, I would be the good person. I just sometimes, when I think, especially of villains or other, you know, doing really nasty things, I thought, But, you know, you want to understand the villain. You want to know where they're coming from, to be real, not a cartoon character. But I think it would be much more fun to be the heroine and have some grand adventures. So, and what occupation? Well, let's see. You know, it's kind of fun. The story I'm writing now is this Christmas novella in the Swift River series, and I'm really drawn to this character who is she designs dresses, and she's designed
Oh, nice.
the wedding dress for Christmas wedding, for Olivia's Christmas wedding at Carriage Hill. So that would be kind of fun.
That would probably be kind of fun. I would love to be a buyer for clothes because
I love
clothes. It would be fun, but I always wanted to be the villain in somebody's book. I wanted to be a character in somebody's book.
Uh-huh. Oh, that would be fun. We could put you as it. We could make you a villain. How would we do that, though?
Yeah, well, you know, you just asked me to tell you. I'm really good with going after people for money, but he told me. I was really good when I went in. My mom was a very strong person. She was the one that inspired me to read a million books a week and to do book reviews too. And
good for her.
Yeah, she was tough. She made me take notes and things like that. So I guess that I don't think I would want to be like her in this story, but I've always wanted to be a villain in somebody's story. So maybe I would be the book reviewer that everybody wanted to get because she panned books. Or the writer
that did
the exposés on the town people and found the little skeleton in everybody's closet and reported
that's
it.
That's right, and found the wrong one. Yeah. Well, there's different kinds of villains. There's a villain who's just like a really annoying person or somebody who's just doesn't do the right thing. And then there's the villain who takes it too far. So if you think about, about ourselves and you look at our own, like maybe our weaknesses or our flaws or something, and then you just twist it up and, ratchet that up, you could end up with a real true villain. Or if, who's the author who said she wrote the book? Is it Sue Grafton? I may not have that right, but she created her first mystery was based on how she would kill her husband if she were going to kill him, the one she divorced.
Oh, nice.
So, So, I mean, you just never know what you could come up with. So it's like you could be the, I don't know.
Yeah, I
but
always
when I
did,
create
yeah.
Bill,
would you create
I'm
a villain?
To me, the villain has to, it's like you get inside their character why are they doing what they're doing and what do they want, what do they think they're going to accomplish, how do they think they're going to get away with it, and I think that's one of the interesting parts about creating something like a Sharp and Donovan series where you have an actual suspense thing going on, like in Saint's Gate, who would kill a nun, that's how the story opens, who would kill a nun. And so if you get inside of that character and all kidding aside, it can be very creepy and interesting. And then you have something like Cider Brook, where the characters, there's not a villain per se, but you think about a 300-year-old pirate mystery and if he came out there and buried treasure, and who might find that treasure? What might they do with it? What would drive them? And how far would you go with it? What would you do with it? What would you do? That's the kind of thing I ask you. Facing obstacles. You take a strong woman like Samantha Bennett and some of the other characters in the series and her obstacles, the different things that she faces and how she faces those obstacles. Those can test a character, they can build a character, and they can reveal a character.
I liked Loretta, and I liked Maggie, but every time Samantha went off or something happened or she was looking for the buried treasure, I was waiting for the specter or the phantom to come and stomp her, or somebody, to blackmail her and say, I don't think you want to do that because I'm going to reveal all your innermost secrets and you're going to be sorry. And then I was waiting. I'm sure Justin has secrets, too, that he doesn't want anybody to know either.
But, absolutely. And, it's a different Cider Brook, it's contemporary romantic story. So it's and I think that as readers, I read across the board. I read a lot of different kinds of books. There's a very few kinds of books that I don't read, but certainly my favorites would be in the mystery thriller suspense and contemporary mm-hmm. romance women's fiction. And so I go back and forth. And I love to be able to dive into a story where I know there's going to be things going on. It's going to be a great adventure, mm-hmm. like Samantha going after her pirate treasure. But there's going to be apple cake. There's going to be nice linens, you know. So it's mm-hmm. going to be a beautiful setting. And you can just kind of enjoy the relationship. It builds a little bit differently than in a suspense. Like if you're writing, we have the relationship with Emma and Colin, and that's, it's what's going on between them is mm. heightened in a way by the investigations, by the murder of a nun, by the disappearance in Declan's Cross of the American diver in mm. Ireland. But it still has that great, the strong sense of place. I love setting that book in Ireland. And I just finished Harbor Island, which is the next book in the Sharp and Donovan series, and that'll be out in September. And we have some more Irish scenes in it. A lot of the book takes place in Boston, but there's also Ireland.
Well, I expect that one, please. I expect to get that one.
Oh, I'll make sure you get a copy.
I want to get that one. So
I love talking.
This is so much fun.
It's so much fun to talk books. You know, somebody just like, oh, we both just love to read. So that's the fun part.
Yeah, I know. I like it. My mom, like I said, made me read, besides the homework, the violin and the piano lessons and everything, she said I had to read between 6 and 10 books a week for real, take notes on them, make sure I kept the notes so by the time the teacher asked me to do book reports, which I found to be dull and boring because I think book reviews are more fun to write than book reports, I was all ready. So I think that's why I prefer print. Because I'll sit down and I'll read a book and I'll destroy it, literally taking notes, circling passages, and remembering what I want, to remember in the book. So I won't read on my computer because my eyes start to bother me. And there's nothing like a great book that you could take with you to the doctor's office right before he's going to torture you, or the dentist before he's going to pull 3 teeth, or anything like that, and get your mind off of everything. So if you could take the place of any one of the characters in your book, which one do you think you would like to take the place of? Would you want to take Emma's place, or would you want to take Samantha's place? And who influenced you the most to become a writer?
Oh, good questions. Well, I don't... taking the place, I guess it depends. I don't know. Gosh, that is such a... I never have thought about that. When I'm writing, I don't think of myself as the character or myself mm. in that situation. Of course, with the Swift River Valley series, that's where I grew up. That's what I know. That's home. But on the other hand, with the Sharp and Donovan series, I love Boston. I love Southern Maine and Ireland. Oh, my gosh. Mm. We're getting ready to go to Ireland again. So I think it would be fun to have a grandfather who's an art detective. That would be cool. Mm. But then I think it would be fun to be in the Swift River series too, and just have apple cake and pancakes and never gain an ounce.
Me too.
Or, so that all could be a lot of fun. And what did you ask? Woman writer? Did you?
Yeah. Which writer or which person? Which person influenced you the most?
Well, I have. Certainly with writers, just writers that I've read when I was a kid and discovered in the library, the old copies of Mary Stewart and Helen McGinnis, Agatha Christie.
Me too.
Those were ones I just devoured those books. Just absolutely loved them. And with Mary Stewart, I loved her characters. You think about the moon spinners, they're kind of going on an adventure. They're going mm-hmm. to exotic places. It was just so, it's just so wonderful in the way she describes just the sunlight, coming, like dappled shade and stuff. She's just a wonderful writer. So definitely influenced me. And then as far as a person, very, very early on when I was a kid, I was very, very fortunate to have a teacher, and she then became the librarian at my school, Helen Renoff, God bless her. She just believed in me. She would, on her own time, read whatever I was writing. She never, it's really a wonderful person because she's extremely well-read, but she was happy with whatever it was I was writing. So I had a story, I wrote my one, like, short story about some grim topic, and the guy ends up beating his head against the wall or something. It was just really grim. And I knew when I wrote that story that that was not the direction I wanted to go in. I love a happy ending, basically. I love things that work out. I love great settings. I love fun characters and characters that I care about and characters that I love. And she just encouraged me to dig deep and write what I wanted to write. And she would sit there with her pencil. She had this little red pencil, and she always had one in her bag or something. You know, she'd sharpen and she would work on, and she could drill down into a sentence. And so there I was in high school by this time, and she could take and look at a sentence and understand how, you know, help me understand how to make it just a better sentence. Never mind the whole story, but sometimes you just drill down to that one sentence. So she was very influential and very, very encouraging. And I've been fortunate. I've had many people along the way. I've had a lot of writers, a lot of creative people. We've had the wet blankets in our lives. And I certainly had a few of those, but most of the time I've had very, very encouraging people.
Well, I learned a long time ago that, you know, there are a lot of people that are critical, and you have to just say, okay, thank you very much, and not get bent out of shape if somebody criticizes you or says they don't like what you wrote or whatever. I believe that if you have faith in what you're doing and you believe what you wrote is right, then that's fine. There are all going to be people that are going to give bad reviews. There are people that are going to be critical. There are going to be people that are going to say, oh, well, I would never read that book because I don't like where the story takes place. So it really doesn't matter. I think the person that influenced me the most was my aunt. Like I said, when I was 3, she told me I was going to become an educator. And thank God I listened, because I was a reading and writing staff developer and a dean of discipline. And I always told the kids, you know what? You're right. You can hang on to a sentence. There's always a way to make something better, so that when they wrote a composition or a story and they would say to me, okay, I'm done, I go, no, you're not, because now you're going to go back and we're going to look for this or that. But you know what? When you said red pen, she used the red pen to show you how to write a sentence, but she didn't use the red pen to mark up the paper to tell you how grammar mistakes, right?
Right.
Exactly. And that is every child's worst fear, is that when they write, and that, I mean, to encourage children to want to express themselves, they feel that they have to write in a no-fear kind of situation. And the one thing I never did was take a red pen to anything. And they're always
exactly.
The first.
Exactly.
You
know, yeah. Yeah, and she did have that ability, but she would sit there with her red pencil, and she could point to things. And it was almost like, it's almost like the red pencil was in my hand so that I could see what I needed to do.
Yeah.
That's the thing. And I had, you know, there's the whole idea of dealing with criticism there's a place for things. I mean, once you've done something and it's out there, it's people have their own relationship with it. But when you're working on a project, and you know, I've been very, very fortunate to work with some wonderful editors. They're pretty much all women, and the ones who are able, you know, they kind of get, I think of it as getting inside, you know, my vision of the story, and just asking the right, sometimes it's just the right question, or there'll be one thing and you just say, oh, okay, and you see it in a way that's helpful, as opposed to a way that's like, okay, I got to throw it all out. I start over.
Yeah.
Because it is, you could be, and there's a point too, and I tell, like when I talk to new writers, you know, to think about at what point do you want to have input? Because if it's too soon in the process, like if they have a critique group, say, you know, I've had some friends and writers who come up and they say, well, they don't write because the critique group said or something. And I said, well, maybe it just was too soon. And you have to think about that, when to show something, because it could be too soon, or it could be like, it's like you really need to just let it go and move on to the next book. It's time.
That is so true. So before we end, we have about a few more. We have 10 minutes. I'm looking at the time over there. Let me just tell everybody my picks for this month. Providence Rag, Bruce DeSilva. You want to read it. It's about the Craig Page murder, serial killer. And I that was another one of those books where I read it in an hour and a half, 400 pages, and couldn't put it down. In what they call, friends, zap time. Another book that I'm doing the review, I'm posting it next Friday, and I am very proud to say I am reviewing for France Tours, yes, Citadel by Kate Moss, about the French Resistance. Absolutely. Usually it takes me about 2 hours, maybe 2.5, to read 700 pages. I took my time because I wanted to make sure that I understood the text and that I got it right. Of course, Cider Brook by Carla Nergis, you definitely want to read it. It was one of my top picks for the month. And a book that I got that's quite original. It's about 3D printing, and it's about Leo, the printmaker. And if you want to learn about more about 3D printing and a very good skill art for kids, you might want to read it. It's by Carla Dennis, and she's going to be on March 27th. And those are my picks for the month. And what's next for Declan's Cross, and what's next for are you going to bring Samantha back?
Well, I'm going to be starting, once I finish the Christmas novella, I'm diving right into Echo Lake, which is the next book in the Swift River series. And I've already started it, really, but I like to do a little bit and let things simmer and then dive back in. And so I'll be working on that. And that, I mentioned Justin Sloan is one of six, and he's one of, so he's five brothers and one sister. Well, that one sister is
Heather,
the heroine in Echo Lake.
Oh, good. I was wondering if you're going to bring Heather into it, because I didn't get to know her that well. So that's good. I have that down on my list as another book that I have to read and have to receive. That is good.
What's good for
the other one you just said, Harbor Island.
Harbor Island. And that comes out in September. And that it's going to have a gorgeous cover, I can tell you that. It's Harbor Island refers to one of the harbor islands in Boston. And and when you're on these, there's like a couple of dozen, a little more than, is it like 36 or something like that? Anyway, there's a bunch of these islands in the harbor. And they look, if you're, and some of them are open to the public and some of them are not, but you look back at Boston, at the skyline of Boston, and Emma Sharp goes out there and finds a woman who has been killed, and that sets off the whole story for Harbor Island. So it's but it also brings in Ireland. So because the woman is, there's an art thief in Declan's Cross. So it's we find out more about the art thief in Harbor Island. But as I say, you could don't have to read the books in order, although I think it would be great to, Declan's Cross will be out in paperback in July. And there's also a prequel, little e-novella called Rock Point, and it's available now online as an e-novella, but for those who love print, and I've heard from many readers who say, please, I think you're going to have it in print. Yes, we are. It's going to be a bonus story in the paperback of Declan's Cross and then in Harbor Island. It'll be in the hardcover. It'll be included in print in both those books.
Oh, good. Then I get to
review. I'm very, very excited.
Oh, I'm excited, too, because I get two books in one. So final question. If Wikipedia put you in their database as one of the top women authors for Women's History category, what would they say about you to place you in a special Women's History category in Wikipedia? Because I think they should.
Well, I would hope. That's an interesting thing. It's like, you know, it's almost like writing your own, you know, epitaph or something. But I would just hope that they would say that she wrote some good stories and had a great family and a great time. So because I don't think about any of that. I think that when I sit down to write, mm-hmm. I'm thinking about the story and my, you know, the readers out there who just want a good story for today, for this afternoon, you know, for sitting by the fire on these cold winter days or in the hammock when we're finally in hammock weather up here in the Northeast. And that's what I think about, is just the here and the now and what the stories are that I'm writing now and my family, you know, my family and my friends. Those are my priorities.
Those are good priorities. I want to know everybody next Wednesday at 10 a.m. on Chat Time with Fran Lewis on Red River Writers. I will be interviewing Danny Schechter, the author of Mandiba, the 26 Faces of Nelson Mandela. And on Thursday, to continue with Women's History, at 4 o'clock, Tess Gerrinson will be my guest. Yeah. The following
week. Oh, she's fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah, she is good. We're going to talk about Jane Rizzoli, Moira Isles, and some of the other strong women characters that she's created, and her career as a medical examiner. The following week, we're going to have Dr. Maxine Thompson, Marcia Cook, Rita Plush, Carla Dennis, and I'm not telling you who the mystery New York Times bestselling author is, because then that would give it away to my guests, and then they would know. But it's somebody that writes on your style and really one of my other favorite romance novelists. That's all I'll say. I won't say more than that. So can you tell everyone where we could learn more about you?
You can visit my website, carlaneggers.com. I'm actually going to be doing a whole new website here over the next couple of months, so that'll be a lot of fun. And I'm also on Facebook and Twitter.
Yes, I know, because that's why I posted the review of Cyderbrook on Facebook.
Facebook's fun, yes.
It is. I'm very careful what I write on that. I only post my reviews. I don't write anything else. And maybe if it's one of my niece or nephews that have won a contest or have done something wonderful, I'll just say congratulations. I don't write too much on there. I try to stay away from, you know, all the conversations and the discussions, because sometimes I wonder, like, you know, what are people really thinking. But I want to thank you so very much. And I can't wait to get Harbor Island. And it's coming out actually for my birthday in September. That's good. Nice present.
Awesome. Awesome.
Yeah.
We'll get your copy. And...
Yeah, I want a signed copy.
Thank you so much.
You're so very welcome.
All right.
And thank you very much. And have a nice night, everybody. And thank you and good night.